Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Canvas Shop. Unlucky episode number 13, as it just so happens to be. Quite the coincidence, actually, because this interview was difficult to schedule, and right after we conducted it, the world ended. So, unlucky indeed. Because of that, because of the current events, which I don't like to talk about very much, and I really don't talk about specifically anything current that's going on, I've prepared a little bit of an essay. It's 15 minutes long, so it's maybe a little bit more than a little bit of an essay, but I think you'll enjoy it. It's about the state of the art industry in general, and where I plan on going with podcasting and my artistic career as well. If you want to skip ahead and you don't care about my opinions or my feelings, then just go to the 17-minute marker, and that will be the beginning of the interview with Jenny Vias, which was a lovely interview. I had a lot of fun, and I hope you enjoyed the nostalgic sounds of a bustling cafe in the background. So enjoy. I will see you guys next time. So today is May 24th, 2020. I feel compelled by current events to discuss a little bit before this podcast, which is about this podcast, artwork in general, and personal opinions thrown in there, spiced around, of course. Everything's changing. I'm sure you knew. Either it's changing or it's changed. Pretty much most everything. Hopefully not where you live. Hopefully that has stayed the same, and your family and whatnot. But your work life, your social life, your income, all those things have changed. And it's kind of creepy. And I think my perspective and this podcast are two things that are included in that. And I'm a little apprehensive to state out loud how I feel about art, but right now especially, it feels pretty decadent and petty, unfortunately. Don't get me wrong, I love artwork, and I'm still making art very slowly, but compared to the historical events that are going on right now, it's different. It doesn't feel as important as other forms of artwork, really, like literature, furniture, really. That's one thing that I've been feeling a lot of pressure to do a little bit more of, is creating functional artwork and designing things. And I think my art's going to take a little bit of a turn that route for a few reasons. Obviously, the decadence and pettiness of opening weekends at galleries and trying to sell paintings and trying to tell people about paintings, but also the economics of it. Because chances are we're in for an economic downturn for possibly an entire generation. And I only bring that up because when things like that happen, artists get hit very hard. Maybe if you're involved in some blue chip art dealing, that sort of thing, you're fine, because a lot of extremely wealthy people use art as an asset. But when it comes down to an independent gallery or emerging artists, it's rough because people don't have money to play around with to just beautify their homes, beautify their lives even. That's going to go onto the back burner when people have to pay bills. So that's a little bit of a business side of it. I wish that wasn't the case. I wish we definitely lived in some sort of utopian anarchistic type of society where anybody could do anything that they want and be just fine and continue their lives and where they live and whatnot. But that's not quite the case. And I don't have all the space for my artwork. If I keep creating things, it's either going to get rolled up or thrown away if someone else doesn't take it or buy it. So what does this mean? For this podcast, current events are definitely impeding interviews. The interview that you're about to listen to was recorded back in January, I believe. Pretty much pre-stay-at-home order, for sure. So it's a little bit weird listening to the interview and hearing the sounds of a kitchen and people rustling around in the background inside of a restaurant. Because I haven't been inside of a restaurant in so long. It's terrible. Because that ties in with the other thing. Public space is, it's becoming expensive in a way. In a literal way, if you really want to assume that people are 100% economic beings, then being in a public space with a lot of people around is fiscally risky. Because if you get sick, you could be out of work for 2 weeks and staying at home. And for anybody who is a wage earner, like myself and most people in the world, I don't know how correct that is, because America is not a, or the Western world in general is not a 100% representation of how the rest of the world works. And I'm woefully ignorant on some of those things, like India and China. But if you're a wage earner, being out of work for 2 weeks could be absolutely devastating. So why risk going to the art opening or to the art center on a first Friday or second Friday or third Friday, fourth Friday, first Saturday or whatever? And being around a bunch of people, it could get you sick. A lot of people just aren't going to do it. And that's going to have a big effect on art. It's going to have a big effect on my enjoyment of art and the participation that I can have in the community. Because that's one thing that I like to do, is just walk around and meet people and shake hands and talk about art and spread germs just everywhere. Which, in a world where the common cold and the flu, common flu, are the most dangerous things, it's not that big of a deal. But now, today, it's different. And it's affecting me. Maybe a little bit more than it should, because I'm staying at home and listening to podcasts and probably a little bit more news than usual and getting a little bit of that fear, uncertainty, and doubt for the future. But it's also been a primer for my interest in wanting to explore broader topics and bring those to an audience. So that's, I think, going to be my next project. I don't think the canvas shop is going to die per se, but it's going to be not very active. And I say that knowing full well that it has not been very active for this last season. My excuse being that I took a semester of college and was determined to do well, which I did, no bragging. But that took up all my time, along with working full-time. Sometimes working overtime and going to school full-time. I don't know how I did it. That was insane. But I want to explore broader topics with you guys, as I've been trying to figure out a way to pretty much give myself a liberal arts education from the comfort of my own home without paying for college and whatnot. And as I'm sure you know, the best way to learn is to teach, and it sounds like a cool idea to do little podcasts on chapters of books, on authors, on pieces of philosophy, and so on and so forth, as I'm learning to help make it accessible for people and discover more niche topics and whatnot. Which brings me to my last point. At best, if this doesn't turn into a multi-generational thing, and, well, I don't know. I think regardless if the sickness that's going around becomes an existential multi-generational fact, then whether that happens or not, we're still going to experience a new area of technology and lifestyle. Did I say area? I meant era. Virtual reality, people moving to rural communities, Zoom, of course, has been flourishing as a business model, which is just an example of how people are going into the new decade. People aren't working from offices very much. And I could tell from the start that there's going to be a lot of people that realize their companies are just running absolutely fine without having a fully staffed office, and they're going to just keep people at home. Which could be good, could be bad. I don't know. That's not exactly my my department. But things are changing. Podcasts are probably going to take off a little bit more than they already are. And I mean, I guess I wanted to add this because it's a little exciting. You know, events like these definitely speed up specific things technologically that are for better or worse, but more or less exciting. Like, I've been interested in virtual reality for a couple years now, and the possibilities that that shows, that that could contain, are very interesting. You could have a virtual reality workspace where you have like a little modular building in your backyard that you go into and hook up and go into the office, and you're in a virtual reality area for the whole day and can beam people in from all parts of the world for meetings and hold lectures and for thousands of people if necessary in your backyard and not have to go anywhere. The networking is interesting. It's virtual reality, I'm sure. I don't have a headset, and I've never actually used it. I'm just philosophically interested. I probably will pretty soon. But the social networking aspect is interesting because, as opposed to Facebook, I'm sure that virtual reality is much less fragmented. You're not going to have multiple tabs open with like 5 different Wikipedia articles and 2 different YouTube videos and Spotify and Facebook. So when you're actually communicating with people, you're going to be much more communicative and interested in the conversation. So that's a little exciting, and I want to try and integrate that. I have a friend that has had the idea of starting a virtual reality college, and I think he's still working on it, although it's he's a very early adopter on that. Shout out to CryptoVoxels. And I can't remember the name of his project. I'm sure I'll talk about it again. But anyways, so I hope there's enough excuses and justification in there for you to be thoroughly satisfied from not hearing any more of these episodes for a little while. Oh, and then the biggest thing is I really, really enjoy doing one-on-one, face-to-face interviews. And not so much do I enjoy doing them over the internet. So I'm probably not going to do a lot of interviews, and this podcast is basically an interview podcast. So that's another good excuse for me. Ultimately, if you're interested in any of my future projects, move on over to my website, lanehewitt.com, LaneHuitt, and sign up for my newsletter. I will be sending out emails discussing what's new, every new podcast update, and maybe just to say hello every once in a while, let you guys know that I love you, and so on and so forth. So sign up for that, subscribe to this podcast, and yeah, I hope you enjoy this interview with lovely Jenny Weiss, and that it is just as nostalgic for you as it is to me to hear the sound of a public space in action. So, talk to you guys later. So I'm here with Jenny Weiss, Chicago native artist,
yes.
Graphic designer turned artist.
That's right.
Right. How did you get into painting and graphic design?
So my background is actually e-commerce, e-business. My degree is in graphic design. And when I graduated, I didn't want to, one, I knew I was gonna not gonna make enough money in graphic design, and I wanted to explore the business side of things. I went to UIC here in Chicago, and they didn't have the option of double major at the time when you were in the art school, and I wanted to study. Like, I wanted to study graphic design and marketing at the same time, and I didn't get to get the experience of marketing, so I just decided to, you know, apply that in real life, and I got a job in e-commerce, and I worked in e-commerce for about 15 years, and about 6 years ago, I made the switch to painting, and that's when I started painting, and it's been wild, man.
Nice.
Now I'm an artist, full-time.
Full-time, yeah.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to do the switch between work and full-time?
2 years, I'd say. Because, and this is something important for people to understand, that, you know, following your passion isn't as glamorous, you know, on the front end on Instagram, but it's a hard, tough journey. You have to be smart and strategic about it. I didn't even know I was gonna paint. So for me, this was a surprise. And I, like all great stories start, my story started with a big breakup. I was heartbroken, and I really wanted to understand. We're gonna keep this part very short because it's not my story anymore. At the time it was, but I really wanted to understand the pattern of the breakups that I had had and the kind of relationships I had, you know, kind of engaged in, to really understand my part in that journey and that relationship, so that one, I could forgive him, because in the end it would kind of release me, and two, really understand my part in it, so that when I walked away from it, I knew what I could offer myself more than anybody else as I moved forward and forgive myself, because I had made some mistakes, like, for years. There really should be a class in college for, like, dating 101. Like, I'm not even, I'm very serious about it. I'm actually thinking about pitching it to a university as a discussion course.
Yeah.
Because, like, a psychologist should come in and, like, there should be different topics that we explore because we're not taught emotional literacy. And so for me, during that period of mourning and really saying goodbye to something, a life that I thought was going to happen, open up a door to just, like, this, like, there was no, I literally couldn't risk anything that I was going to lose anymore. Like, I felt like I had lost everything, there was no risk. And so at that point, I couldn't stop thinking about painting, and it was really bizarre. I had never painted before, and it almost felt like an ache that I just had to, like, if I didn't do it, I almost felt like crying. And so I explored it, hated everything I created for about 6 months, made the mistake of sharing it with, on Instagram right away, and I started judging myself, I started comparing myself, right? Like, comparison is like your killer at times. It can be a point of inspiration, but it can also destroy your confidence when you're not ready. I always say, if you don't love your work, nobody else will. And so for me, I had to walk away from social media, spend about 6 months really just playing with my work alone and falling in love with it myself before I shared it with the world. And it was 2015 when I launched this project. And I took all of my learnings for about a year, deep dive into the relationship and the dynamics and the mathematics, per se. I'm very analytical. And so I applied that into this project and explored vulnerability over the course of 100 days, give or take. I painted 100 paintings that explored that topic. And it started initially deconstructing love from a darker place. And then it just kind of evolved from there. And it really became about storytelling from this work. It was a project from Negative Space. So I developed this, like, very signature black and white style that I'm now known for. Mm-hmm. It's a silhouette style. And I explored very, very, like, deeper emotions. It was really wonderful to be able to kind of, like, unpack all of that and start this journey.
Yeah, that's important with life changes like that, is dealing with them, to put it bluntly, you know, processing it all in a healthy way.
Yeah, and I think, for me, this outlet was art, and the only way it happened was when I was willing to be honest. And there was no other medium that made me more honest than, you know, painting, because there was no running away anymore. I had to face myself, and the minute I did that, I'm telling you, people just connected with it differently. And I am an avid reader. I'm huge, like, a philosophy nerd. And for me to be able to tie all of that in and, like, have people message me and connect with it was such a gift, because it's a lonely world to be in that space of just deep thinking at all times.
What kind of philosophy influenced your work?
I'm a big Plato fan. I'm a big Aristotle fan. And Socrates, of course, but, like, as it evolves, those three are my favorite. And I've studied that with my dad so much, but then we also have Hindu philosophies that are very ancient. And my dad's incredibly learned. He's a philosopher. And so we've talked about origin of life and God. And it's just been really wonderful for me to be able to, like, navigate my existential crisis. I was born an existentialist. So for me to be able to tie all of that into my work and find an audience that actually understands it, it's such a beautiful thing.
Oh, I get it. I've never felt more at home than in a couple Dostoevsky books that I've read.
And it's like when you get into that space and when you can connect, when you can see others get you, it's a different place. It's a different world. Suddenly I felt like I belonged in a world. I found myself.
Yeah, that's what's really cool about liberal arts and philosophy and all of that, is it connects you to the larger timeline of human history that we know, at least.
Yeah, and exactly, right? And I feel like there are so many learnings that we just don't even know that exist in our, in history.
Absolutely.
I feel like we're repeating, like, if you actually, so there is, one of my favorite podcasts is called Philosophize This.
Okay.
And it's just one guy talking for an hour, and he's got a very, like, simple, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Very simple, clean voice. So if you're looking for someone to, like, not make you fall asleep, he's not the guy, but it's absolutely beautiful. He unpacks either a philosophical topic or a philosopher or an era in every episode. And he literally starts from Socrates, before even that. So he starts from the first philosopher, per se. and Heraclitus, I think. I forget the name. So it's all started from Greece and Rome, and so like he unpacks all of it throughout. Like, I think he's done over 100 episodes. And that, to me, like, is where I can... I am seeing so much history repeating itself now. And it just doesn't... Like, it was just surprising to see all of these things happen today that all of these philosophers talked about.
Yeah.
Like, in 2000 BC.
I mean, people are people.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's the one thing that... creates what I just talked about with really connecting with Dostoevsky, but it also creates anti-vaxxers.
We're not going to talk about anti-vaxxers.
Anything else like that.
Anti-vaxxers, but, man.
So I think it's important. What kind of strategy did you have going from, I guess, the commercial world to the artistic world?
That's a great question. I actually, so one of the questions I get is, how did you embark upon this journey? Did you go all in? No, I was working full time. I had a job. I had an e-commerce at Obra. We had a brick and mortar store across the studio. It was called The Obra Store. And my boss brought me, the brick and mortar boss brought me on board to launch it online. I headed that for 4 years. And when the show ended here and the Obra network moved to LA, we shut shop here. So for the first time, I have a little bit of a time. She gave us a sabbatical, which was nice. She's incredibly generous. And I took some time, like 2 months off, to really understand what I wanted to do. I turned down some big corporate jobs. And that's when I realized that this wasn't what I wanted to do anymore. It was very clear. I was wasting people's time. And at that point, I had always known coming out of college I was going to be somewhat entrepreneurial. I just didn't know what that passion was going to be. Mm-hmm. So at this is still, we're talking 2011. I had no idea I could paint.
Okay.
And so I went into the startup world to understand how to build a company from the ground up, how to raise money, and I worked in that space for 2 years. And during that time, I had started consulting with for digital marketing with clients in Chicago and independently. And so they were restaurant owners or business owners, event spaces that I'm friends with, and kind of capitalized on my, I'm a networker by heart. So like, I take business cards. I always tell people, like, go out, take business. I can go to a nightclub and take business cards home. It's just, it's how life should be. Like, you should always, I'm not saying you should always be in work mode, but you're
always be connecting with
people. Always be connecting with people. You know, you just never know. I've never looked for a job because I've always had connections. And so I turned all of those connections into art connections after that. I started digital marketing for them. So I still, to this day, do that. About 25% of my income comes from that. So I don't have to worry about dropping my prices for art. That was my strategy. I did a lot of research on what kind of an artist I wanted to be. I wanted to be a collector artist with, like a coveted artist. And in order to do that, your prices cannot be low. And so from out the door, my prices were never cheap, mainly because I also knew that I had something very special to offer and I put in a lot of heart and soul in it. I wasn't willing to drop the prices. So I consulted with clients and I enjoy it because it keeps my, you know, whatever brain it is, the left brain or the right brain, whatever, the analytical side. It
right
keeps
brain.
Me, the right brain, right? Yeah. It keeps it fed and it keeps me happy. And then it pays for all my expenses, health insurance, all of that I don't need to worry about. And then I started kind of, it allowed me to walk away from projects that I didn't need and want and align with my, you know, branding. And I think that's what something like that will allow you to do. So my advice to people who want to kind of follow their passion, start doing it an hour a day. You don't need a studio. I don't have a studio yet. It's a basement of a house, you know. Like, I don't have a need for it. I'm not going to get it. Mm-hmm. But start an hour a day, which is what I started. And it just kind of took off from there.
It's very mild strategy. I think those are the ones that work the most.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have a big plan. I mean, that's, I'll say that. The only plan was I wasn't going to go all in. One, I wasn't financially set up for that. And two, I honestly didn't know what style was going to, like, I was going to end up with. Because this was all new. And I also wanted to approach it as a business and not just an art business. Like art, yeah. You know, like it wasn't just like a creative art space. It was a business for me. I wanted to be a businesswoman. And this was my entrepreneurship angle. Like, why not do that and bring my passion into it? And so I approach every proposal, every contract, everything from a business standpoint. I have, you know, a lawyer draw on my contract. It's very detailed. Day one, I had contracts in place. Even for a $300 painting, I had a contract in place. I'm very methodical, very business oriented from that standpoint. I created my business entity. I had my name. I bought JennyBS.com. I don't know, 12 years ago?
Okay.
I've been paying for it before I knew what I was going to do.
Yeah, I own LaneHewitt.com too.
As you should.
Yeah, you don't want someone taking that and then charging you when you're famous.
Yeah.
They want $1 million for it.
I agree. So for people who heard me say Jenny BS, it's Jenny Bias or BS. My original pronunciation is BS from India.
Yes.
And then America has just become Bias. So it's just...
Yeah.
I'm tired of correcting people. But I go by both.
That is a problem with Americans, isn't it?
No, it's not. It's
very
just...
stubborn with pronunciations.
No, if you correct the fifth person, you're like, yep, it's Bias.
Yeah. I tend to not correct people with names very much.
Yeah, it is what it is, right?
Even with my very simple name, it gets messed up.
No way.
Very frequently.
It's just a simple name.
Yeah, is it L-A-Y-N-E? I get that one a lot. Which is like kind of the female spelling.
Oh,
I've seen that
a
couple
spell
times.
L-A-N-E. Yeah, that's interesting.
But yeah.
That's interesting.
So what? How did you learn about the art space? Coming from nothing to doing it full time.
Honestly, it was like a shot in the dark because I remember, so one thing I will tell you, because I had the luxury of, or the security, I should say, not luxury, it's never luxurious, the security of having my own established digital marketing consulting business set up already,
mm-hmm.
I had the ability to really just play. And that's what I did with my first project, which was in 2015, I explored 100 Vulnerable Days is the project's title on Instagram. If you Google that, I mean, if you search for that hashtag, pretty much I think my work shows up. And my goal was really to just unpack my emotions and really kind of heal. And so I remember though, day two when someone asked me if I'm selling them, I'm Googling, I'm like, how do you price your art? And so I've studied, I did a lot of research, like anything in life, I do a lot of research. And so I went deep dive, I read books, and I'm happy to share, you know, a list of books that you can share in the, you know, glossary. And I read a lot of books and really kind of understood the kind of artist I wanted to be, the kind of price point I wanted to be at, and the trajectory of it. I had a very loose mental plan, a 5-year plan on where I wanted to be. And
I believe so. The screen just shut off, so I was a little skeptical.
Okay. Sorry, we were just checking if it's on. And yeah, so that was kind of like the loose plan, but I didn't have the perfect strategy for it as far as that. Because now I'm becoming a lot more strategic because I have some bigger plans, which I can't wait to share. But that
you can't, I'm assuming.
What was that?
But that you can't share.
Not yet, because I'm not ready. Like, it's not, it's all like a lot of stuff up in the air right now. So once I have a prototype of the first item, then I can start talking about it. But I've been wanting to get into fashion for a very long time, so that's something I'm diving into.
Okay.
Jewelry and clothing and couture, which is my big dream.
Yeah.
But then I'll always be painting, of course.
Of course. What did you have any influences that influenced that first line of work or any
from a creative
subsequently?
Standpoint?
Yeah.
So I could always sketch. I mean, let's not think that I just woke up one day and I was like, oh great, I'm gonna paint. No. I could always draw. Like I did that for fun all the time. I could resketch, and I always say, if you can resketch cartoon figures fairly close to what you see, that means you've got a good idea of perception, because it requires a little bit of math in for you to translate that on to paper or anything that you're recreating work in. And so I could always do that. And in graphic design, we had a few art classes that we had to obviously take.
Yeah.
And my grandpa, who's no longer with me, would always be so excited when I would come home and be like, okay, what'd you create today? This was just this like very short-lived one semester class that I showed him work, you know, the sculpture class. And he would be so excited. And it just, I remember that. He could always draw. We had paintings all over our home growing up in India. Mm-hmm. Local painters had painted all these paintings. And so for me, art was never, like, I feel like I was always meant to be an artist. I just didn't know that I could actually do it. Because you just don't study art, like, I'm Indian. Like, even going into graphic design, it was an outlier thing. you become an engineer, you become a doctor. And I was like, I'm going to go into graphic design.
Yeah.
So it was bizarre. But speaking of graphic design, my big dream was to create brand identities for companies, which I ended up doing in e-commerce, mm-hmm. which is nice. So,
how much of that did you incorporate in your art brand?
It's interesting, man. It's
probably
a lot.
Quite a bit.
It's a lot. I built my own website. I came up with, like, I wanted a logo that was very clean, which ended up being my artist signature. Branding is always on my mind. I'm very, very, like, I'm always thinking. Even the voice and on Instagram, I made this switch on Instagram. The day I decided, oh hey, after my breakup, my social media is going to become my medium to sell work. And I was very, very strategic about that. And that's something I always advise people. Like, you can start with your personal social media, and that's where you can build a presence for what you want to do. And that's, no joke, my number one space where I sell work. Hmm. So, it's my Instagram, my Facebook after that, and then my website. The three areas where people contact me from.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
How long have you been running your Instagram page?
I'd say 4 years.
4 years?
Yeah.
Have you noticed?
Really started doing 2 years ago, like actually focusing on it 2 years ago.
Okay. Have you noticed in like the last year, the Instagram stuff? Like with hashtags getting less visibility.
Oh, yeah.
And
I mean, it's a pay-for-play model, right?
The algorithm changes.
Yeah, the algorithm changes. Yeah, it's a pay-for-play model. So I do end up doing ads. I do sponsored posts. So I don't do any, I mean, I think I'm ready at this point to start going a little more strategic on the ad placements. I just don't have the capacity to do it myself. And that's when you know, hire people. You don't need to learn everything. Do what you're really good at. Hire people who are better at things that you don't want to learn. So I don't want to learn advertising, and I'm gonna work with someone to do that, because right now I'm just literally just boosting posts and pushing it, because I did start seeing that earlier last year, I was at, I'm not kidding, I was at 1,200 followers. And I was like, how am I gonna get to, like, let's say 10,000, which I'm like 200 people away from. So people like my work, like this page, because there's a big, like, gift that Instagram gives you at 10,000 followers, you can start linking from your stories, which you can't do until you get to 10,000.
So
in order to get to any number, I start boosting, and I started seeing a significant, like, increase in my followers and genuine followers. These are people who are, like, willing to buy work. And so it works. It's just, you have to spend money. It's just, and Instagram knows that. They lure you in initially with free likes and free visibility, and then they just locked you in with ads.
So, yeah, I noticed it very subtly between, I think it was probably the end of 2017, mm-hmm. I started posting sketches and some drawings on Instagram, and some of them would easily, just with like a couple hashtags, blow up well beyond the people that I know. And then lately, like, upgraded my photography setup and everything looks very nice and clean, and it's just my friends that like it, and like a couple people that probably follow hashtags.
Yeah, I mean, if you, like, don't do ads now, you're gonna get lost. It's really sad. I spend anywhere from $300 to $400 a month now on advertising.
Damn.
I know. We gotta build it in, right? They say 10% minimum should go back into marketing.
Yeah, that's true.
If you wanna build and if you wanna grow, you gotta run ads. It's just, I mean, I come from e-commerce background, so for me, advertising is big, but I just didn't honestly want to spend the money. I kind of did sit on it for a while, and then buying followers was never appealing to me, because what's that going to do? I wanted people who liked my work because they liked it and wanted to buy it. Mm-hmm. And I'm so lucky. I'm so glad I did that, because everybody who follows me right now, there are buyers on there. There are fans, and there are people who, like, genuinely connect with my work, and that's what I wanted. Like, you buy followers, sure, you'll get people who look at your work and say, sure, this is, she has 10,000 followers, 20,000 followers, maybe I'll buy her work. But this is a pure conversion now for me, because they've been following my story. Some of them have been following my story since day one. And I truly think that you fall in love with the story of the artist more than the work.
Yeah, the story's has a big impact on people. Yeah. I'm really terrible at it.
And I think that's my piece of advice.
Communicating personality.
Yeah. But I feel like you have personality, right? And people are just scared to open that up on social media. I feel like the more authentic you are, the more willing you are to be vulnerable, that is really where it opens up space for people to trust you.
Yeah.
And that's my piece of advice to everybody. Like, once a week, you should be writing something or posting something that scares you. Like, I write these, like, really detailed, very, like, self-revealing blog posts, and I write those. Whenever I hit post, my heart is racing. I have to walk away from my phone for about a half hour or 2 hours sometimes, and I call it a vulnerable lady hangover. It's not my term, by the way. I think, I'm pretty sure Brene Brown coined it.
Vulnerable lady hangover?
Vulnerable lady hangover.
Like vulnerability.
When you're vulnerable and you get a hangover from it, like I literally feel like I'm exhausted once I post something very vulnerable. But to me, that is really where connection happens. And the more I started doing that, the more people really started falling in love with my work. So I encourage people, highly, highly encourage creative people to share that, because it's such a golden nugget for people to be able to see you inside.
And I've noticed this same effect, and you can see it too with people talking about social media. You'll either get one side that's like rates of depression are raising.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not good. And then the other side is like, this is making people more creative, and people are out there doing shit and getting things done.
But and I think it can also become daunting, right? If you only see the good stuff from someone.
Yeah.
If that person never shares the struggles of their profession, it's hard to connect with them. Because then you just sit there thinking like, wow, they never struggle. So you put them on a pedestal that you feel like you can never reach.
I think people can kind of see through that nowadays too.
But now it's so transparent.
It's become pretty obvious.
Now you can't bullshit your way on Instagram, man. Yeah.
But I think the differentiation between both sides has to do with outlet. Because at least from my own personal experience, I've had times where I'm posting a lot and communicating with people and doing less of the scrolling through feeds.
Yeah.
And then there's times where I'm just like ghosting and just way too busy to post on Instagram or social media or anything like that. And you wind up in a different mindset.
Agreed.
Of like, I don't know, maybe it's a voyeuristic sort of perspective.
Oh my God, you're talking like the whole introverted in me. I go through that a lot, and I talk about solitude very, very openly in my on my social media, and I talk about how necessary it is. It's fuel for me to find that space alone, because, and I call it people detoxing. So if I have a heavy social weekend, I need a few days alone, because I get so overwhelmed emotionally, and I think it's like really important to be able to, even on social media, when you share a lot, I need a few days of not sharing, because I do feel like it feels voyeuristic, it feels narcissistic. Even if Instagram, the shitty part is, if you don't post enough, Instagram stops rating your post, and then you have to kind of rebuild every week from that. So ideally, they say, Instagram claims you should be posting 3 times a day. I mean, that's insane.
3 times a day. Yeah, that is insane.
Like, that's not happening. However, once in a while, when I have some really good stuff to share, and I'll share 3 in a row, they do fantastic. But then I'll do that again next day or third day, and it won't do well. So just, like, I think, listen to your gut, one, because you do, I truly believe in sending out the energy that you want to receive. And if you don't feel good about something, I don't think you're going to get that energy back. So when I'm feeling great, those are the days when I post a lot or share a lot. Those are the days when I'm feeling great. When I got kind of like ghost, I guess. I need that space. I need that alone time. And it's okay. Like, do what's right for you. And I think the authentic audience can see that. When you walk away and you come back, they just know that you're taking your time.
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of big accounts that don't post very often.
No.
They still get millions of likes because
they're genuine,
thousands of authentic followers that want to see.
Yeah, there's this genuinity right in it, and it's beautiful to see that.
So back to art.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of something.
Sure.
social media and art.
And what?
And art.
Social media and art?
Yeah. Has it influenced what you paint at all?
Oh my God, all the time. I mean, there are some artists that I absolutely love, and I am notorious for sharing work on my stories from different artists, and I'm such a fan. I'm such a fangirl. And I think sometimes I can get too caught up in other people's work when I'm like, oh my God, I should be doing this in my work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it has complete influence in a beautiful way. A lot of my work has evolved because I've seen other artists take risks that I feel like I'm not ready to take yet. I am currently developing a style that I have no idea where it's gonna go, but I am willing to take this risk because I've seen one artist do something so beautiful that just instantly connected with me. And for me, that's very important. If I instantly connect with something, that means I have something very special there. But yeah, social media, hugely, hugely for me, that's a huge influencer. Because like,
do any artists come to mind that you're following right now that have made an impression?
Their Instagram handles are very like hard to remember, so let me pull them up real quick. But there is one artist like who I absolutely love. His name is, I actually, if you look at my my board for artists I love on Instagram, there's like hundreds of photos and paintings that I've saved. This artist is the new artist that I just discovered, by the way. He's incredible. It's T.A.J. Francis. And I think he's from, I forget where he's from, but his work is incredible. He does canvas and digital work.
Yeah, that's really cool.
It is, like, it's just, I can't even imagine the amount of patience it requires to paint that. Another artist that I absolutely love, who's very, like, I'd say I am inspired by him. His name is Evan Parr. Evinpar, and he has a monochromatic style similar to mine, but his work is a lot more distressed, and it's just, it speaks to me like on a level that no other artist's work speaks to me.
Yeah, I really.
And
like
it's really
that.
Hard to see this kind of work in museums, for example, because I feel like this is a new genre of work that artists are creating today that is like incredible to me.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now that I'm thinking about it, because I feel like I've seen,
if you look at Evan's work, for example, right?
Like, yeah, I've seen that kind of style, very kind of minimalistic, distressed portraiture. But I can't think of any real like beatnik artists or anything before then that were doing
that. And it takes a lot of discipline to do something what Evan does. Evan Parr, again, P-A-R. Yeah. What he does, or even what I do, to be able to walk away or to be able to distort a painting or distress it, it really takes a lot of discipline because you, one, have to be willing to destroy something and take a risk that it might not turn out cool. And the second thing is to really know when to put the brush down. Or for me, a lot of times put my fingers down because I paint a lot with my fingers. And which is why I admire these kind of artists who have this like end point where it's never just like, you never think it's done, but then at some point you're just like, okay, that's it, I'm gonna walk away from it. And there's just like really beautiful discipline to that.
That is kind of the hardest point in the painting, is knowing when it's finished.
I know, I have so many paintings that are in work, and everyone, a lot of times I get asked, like, how do you know when it's done? I'm like, sometimes when someone wants to buy it, it's done.
Yeah.
Like, all right, I've been working on it for 2 years, take it.
Yeah, I think that was Picasso's thing. I don't know if he said it directly, but it's done when it's sold.
Yeah, exactly, right, yeah. So if someone wants to buy it, and because I could paint something for 10 years, I'm not joking. I could just keep going back to it, so.
Oh, yeah. Well, Da Vinci worked on the Mona Lisa for 30 years or something like that.
I wonder what she looked like originally, what his idea was.
Yeah, I don't know. There's another painting of the Mona Lisa that was, they thought it was a copy for the longest time, but
he
What?
He painted it?
No. The theory now is that it was one of his students painted it alongside him, because it's from a different perspective. So they thought it was a copy for the longest time, but when you look at it in the Mona Lisa in proportion to the background, it's
that's
shifted
interesting.
A little
bit. I've never heard of this. That's so interesting.
So maybe if you overlay the two...
That would be really cool.
You could get
maybe
a more accurate depiction of who she was.
That is true. just Monet, thought. Didn't they say Monet painted over his canvases again and again? So they're like every painting.
Oh,
had,
probably.
Like, he had, I just like, a lot of paintings underneath.
I just watched a documentary of his. He worked
the
on.
Lilies? Oh yeah, it was like 12 years.
I don't know if it was the lilies. I mean, that's longer than the one I'm remembering. But he worked on this church and was painting it, and was writing in his diary or some letters that like he just can't do it. The light was wrong today.
Oh yeah, I see. Yeah.
So, or there was too many clouds, and now it's almost winter time.
Well, he went through. He went through huge depression, right? Like after his wife died. The lilies,
yeah,
actually. If you go to the Art Institute, which by the way is closed because of coronavirus, just got an email today. They're closing for 2 weeks.
Ouch.
I guess that's a good thing. They have too many surfaces to clean.
Yeah.
there's the whole Monet's lilies. I think there's 12 of them or 10 of them here. And you could see, like, it's almost like a madness that you can see on both. Because he painted them again and again and again and again. I can see that. It can become an obsession.
Yeah. It's a rough obsession.
It is, yeah.
Maybe we're fortunate now that we have phones and things to distract us.
I completely
other
agree.
Than
I agree.
If it was a couple hundred years ago,
oh my God,
you'd go home and
I would
cook
lose
some
my mind.
Food
I think
and
I'd
be like, well,
yeah, again and again.
Am I going to read, write, go to work, or paint? I'm going to go paint.
Agree, all the time.
Yeah, he did not have a very happy life.
No.
He was very... like,
well, most artists are melancholy, but you know,
yeah.
I feel like you don't go into the creative. But there is this misconception that artists paint better when they're sad. I don't think they paint better when they're sad. I feel like artists paint better after the sadness. Because you can channel that melancholy once you're happier times, right? Like even Virginia Woolf, who's one of my favorite like diaries that anybody's written. And she talks about it very openly, right? Like depression is... And it's not just depression, it's this, I just talked about it actually, it's this divine discontent, right? Like it's a turn,
okay.
It's a philosophical turn, where you really feel this melancholy, this sadness that you cannot explain. But if you're willing to kind of let it sit through it, let it breathe, and when you emerge from it, there's this joy that comes out of it that's so incredibly beautiful, it's very peaceful. And that serenity is what artists like to paint. It's not the chaos. You can capture something a lot better when you looked at it afterwards. It's like a photograph.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're depressed, usually, like, the symptoms of depression are not
very... No, I don't want to paint. I don't want to do anything.
Yeah. Not very conducive to getting anything done or done thoroughly.
No. My first successful art project was the 100 Vulnerable Days project, and I painted it during a happier time. Yes, I talked about love and darkness and sadness, and I deconstructed the darker side of love as well in it, but it was very much from a reflective standpoint, very much from a learning standpoint, and which is why I was able to do it justice.
Which, yeah, it makes sense.
Which is something I want to, like, people know I'm not sad when I'm painting. I'm happy.
That's great.
Yeah.
Have you gone through any sways since then of like lulls in being able to work or anything like that?
Oh man, artist block is a real thing. I think last year I took off a good 2 months. I just couldn't do anything new. I did commissions because they were very, like as far as the vision goes, very detailed, very controlled. Mm-hmm. Because the client has a vision and you kind of execute it. But my personal work from the studio, it's been very rare, like, that I create something from the studio. So anytime I create a work from my studio and I sell it, it means so much more to me than anything else that I sell.
Mm.
Because a lot goes into it. And so this next series that I'm developing, I am very inspired and I'm very excited because I've been waiting for this. It's been almost a year since I've, like, wanted to do a series of works. And, it's not easy. I mean, you just go quiet for a while sometimes and you
emerge
and, you just have to do that. It's like,
I get it.
A wave in the ocean.
I'm there right now.
Every time you go in there, you come out a little bit cleaner.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good perspective.
It's my therapist's perspective, but I'll take it.
Hey, yeah, sign off on it.
I'll sign off on it. He's not going to know.
No, I'm experiencing that right now. I started kind of a series I called Clout Paintings.
Oh, yeah,
because
I
was reaching out to a bunch of accounts, people I like, musicians, think there's like a model in there that's cool, and just direct messaging them on Instagram and saying, hey, I'm doing a series of paintings. I'll do a portrait of you and shout me out, please. Yeah. That sort of thing. And I'm like halfway through the second one and it's been sitting on the wall.
So I have something to say about that. Sometimes you have to create a discipline. So the 100 Day Project is a beautiful way, because I think it's Da Vinci who said, inspiration exists, you just have to show up, right? Like, it really exists, you just have to show up for it. And the more I paint in the studio, the more I fail, the more inspired I am. So I'm actually, honestly, if we get quarantined, this is the perfect time for me, because I need this time. I could really use the time to hang out in the studio and fail and play. And the 100 Day Project really shifted something inside of me. After, I'd say, day 20, where they say, day 22? 22 days for a new habit, or 21 days or something. It set in, and I couldn't stop thinking about what I'm going to paint today. So there's something to discipline. If you're going to commit to something like a creative work, they say, Julia Cameron has written The Artist's Way, which is a book I think every new artist should read, or every existing artist should actually read this book. It's called The Artist's Way.
Okay.
And she talks about the importance of morning pictures. She encourages everybody to write a journal for 20 minutes every morning. And so come up with a routine. I don't have morning pages, but I do have a 2-hour clean time frame where I don't like interruptions. I like complete quiet time between 7 and 9. And if I don't do that, my day doesn't start like on a calm note that I like to. I read, I catch up on news if I want to. I do whatever I feel like doing at the time. I have books sitting around my bed all the time, so I'll read one of those. So it's just come up with your own routine, and it's incredibly necessary. Discipline in a creative world. Like, every artist will tell you that. Like, I paint it every single day. Every single day, even if I fail.
Well, inspiration's unreliable.
It does, yeah. And I feel like I think that is another thing about social media, right? We're so caught up in presenting finished work so quickly because of these damn like algorithms and likes, and we are living in a like culture. It does dictate how much time you are going to spend failing. And that is something that I do miss when I first started. I for every piece I created, I failed 5 times at least. That was nice to be able to do that. Now I'm so caught up in like, oh my god, I haven't posted something in like a month, a new original piece. I need to post something, and then I'll create something. So Instagram does create that pressure, and I hate that.
Yeah.
From an artist standpoint. I think about it. I'm like, what if I was to walk away for 4 months, take a trip, paint for 4 months, and then share? Would Instagram literally drop me from the algorithm? It probably would.
Yeah, you'd have to rebuild for a while.
Yeah, I'd have to rebuild, and that sucks. And you could just like pick up from where you left off, although everything would change in 6 months.
Yeah, it's the lean startup world.
Yeah. But I think that's the problem. Like, so I do say, encourage people, if you're going to start a project, stick with it, do it, even if it takes. So if you're not sure, if you take on something like a portrait, it's tough. It's not an easy thing. I would do a 30-day project or a 15-day project or a 10-day project. So 100 days is long and tough. Because I failed at that 100-day project since. I haven't finished a single one. I've joined it 3 or 4 times after that. Actually, that's not true. I did one and I did finish it after that. I did a
large
scale. Wait,
so did you make it the 100 days?
I did do. The first one, I made it to 100 days.
You're talking about
the project. So the project I'm talking about, it's called the 100 Day Project, the hashtag. It starts on April 3rd. I haven't seen anything about it, so I don't know if it's happening this year, but it happened for the last 5 years. And everybody joins on Instagram. Someone anchors it on Instagram, this artist. And I joined it in 2015. 2014 I joined, I failed miserably because that's when I was judging my work and I was just getting started. So I walked away from that after like day 22. And then 2015 is when I did the 100 days. I couldn't keep up with every single day towards like the halfway through, because at that point I had like 8 clients or 10 clients, so it was just really busy. But I did finish 100 paintings. And my last one was on December 31st of that year. And that ended up being my centerpiece of my show and the title of my show the year later. So you never know where life's going to take you. I had a solo show in 2016, which is crazy. A year into painting, I had a solo show. So
that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you land that?
Actually, it was great. It was Fulton Market Kitchen. I was their resident artist for a week. I painted live, and Jackie Trezzo, who used to curate artists there, she invited me to paint there for a week. And then at the end of it, the manager, like the managing partner, really loved my work, and he said, let's have a show. And so they ended up doing a show for me upstairs. The Fulton Market has a very cute upstairs level, which can host about 70 people. And so we've done two shows there now, and they've both been like packed. Like, and it's been wonderful. Work sells every time there. I have like a fan base. It's really nice to be able to like call something your small home.
Yeah, so, that's cool.
Yeah. I love doing shows there. It's such a, I encourage artists to go check out this space. People don't even know that it's a restaurant and an art gallery.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard of it yet.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things I haven't heard about in Chicago, but that's one of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. People don't know about this space. It's really beautiful. It's very loft, very open wall space. So it's all bricks.
And where's it at? Is it Fulton?
It's on Fulton. If you go on Fulton past Lake Street and Fulton Street, it's on Sangamon.
Sangamon?
Yeah, Sangamon. Okay. If you end, wherever Sangamon ends, it's basically on the right side of Fulton Market. Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah, although the entire space is now covered with Lauren Nashta's mural. She just painted one there.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know her either.
So she's the one who does the cartoon squiggly faces and stuff. I'm sure you've seen it. It's black and white. It's monochromatic. So all
does she do murals, like street murals?
Yes, she does. She does a lot of street murals. Yep. Yep. So she just painted Fulton Market Kitchen, so if people want to see it, it's pretty signature Lauren. So you're welcome to see it. These like, these faces.
How many solo shows have you done since?
I've done three total. So
three total?
Yeah.
All then, there or
no,
in other
places? No, so I did two there, and then I did one at Gallery Cafe on North Avenue in Wicker Park. And that's an adorable little cafe.
Okay.
Loved working with them. And I sold a lot of work, which was really surprising. But it like, the cool thing about doing shows at smaller spaces like that, like a cafe, for example, you get a whole different set of clientele that aren't able to tap into your work in like areas. Like West Loop has a different clientele, for example. So I got to showcase work here. I would have get messages from people from Wicker Park that I didn't even know. And they had never seen my work. Besides my Federale's wings, which are really famous, you know, in Chicago. So.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's when they were like, "Oh, you painted the wings! I know your work."
Nice. That's a good staple to have.
Yeah, it was nice. That was a strategic move.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
They approached me.
Did you seek it out?
No, they approached me. I mean, I'm telling you, man, I'm really bad about seeking out work. I'm a very privileged artist, and it's sad to say I have yet to seek out a project. Federale's approached me, the team that managed Federale's, like, because they're four, sister four, like, they're the same people who own Big Star and Violet Hour, Federale's, and then whatever, the fourth restaurant. And so they approached me to create these, like, Instagrammable wings, right? Like that was their idea, and they wanted me to paint something close to what Kelsey Montague does. Those are the Kelsey's wings are the what lifts you wings. They're natural, they're massive, and sure, everybody sees photos of her. She has like 100 in all over America now. And so she, they asked me, and like as an artist, I'm like, oh my god, I have an ego, like right? Everybody artist has an ego. I'm like, why don't you just ask her? And they're like, no, we want you to create something that's signature you in your style, because you're local, one, and two, we like your work, we just want something that staple. And so I came up with this signature pattern. It's actually a henna pattern.
Okay.
Yeah, so I drew it like I would draw henna on my hand, and they wanted a little bit of a graffiti feel to it, and I don't do spray painting. I wish I could. Make my life so much easier. I literally hand paint everything. All my murals are hand painted. And so I proposed working with Cesar Perez, who's a local artist who's incredible. And so we came up with this idea of adding those feathers on top that you see that are realistic, like with a shadow. That's his part. And so we painted those. It took us about 2.5 days. And it was a very strategic move on our end, because wings are cliche. But then we wanted something that, one, was Instagrammable because we wanted the presence, and two, honestly, I wanted something that was not ours. You know, those wings are not ours. It became a stage for other people. And then I started getting messages. Once in a while, I get a message from people like who have lost weight or gotten through depression, or someone just celebrated her being sober for 2 years after like being suicidal from alcoholism. And like those messages are like such a gift, because I never expected that. Like it was this like, it's, those wings are not ours, which is what I love about them. They're, you know, the people's wings, the community wings, and it lifts them. And I like, oh, it's such a gift. Yeah.
That's cool.
So I'm glad we did those. Even Caesar, like, who doesn't do anything, any work like that, is, like, loves those wings.
Yeah. Does he have a podcast too?
He does not.
He does not. Okay, there's another Caesar around here that has a podcast. I've never listened to, but I follow him on Instagram.
Artist. No. Caesar is just like, he's pretty well known in Chicago as far as artist goes. He has a lot of murals.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of murals around here.
It's amazing, man. It's, I love everywhere. It. I love, that's one thing I do love about Chicago. They're so supportive of artist community. And it's really, really easy to get help and ask for help, and people, yes, it's a professional riddled with competition, but people are willing to help, and people are willing to work together.
So what do you, besides that, what do you think about the Chicago artist scene, culture as a whole?
I mean, I like it from a camaraderie standpoint. I did not expect that. It's a small community. It's, everybody knows everybody now. And so it's nice to be able to connect with people and know that if I need help, I will always have someone I can lean on. But then I spent literally just 1 week in New York last summer. And the amount of opportunities that opened up within 1 week was mind-blowing from an entrepreneurship standpoint. Like, I have a gallery show lined up end of this month, right? Like, end of this year in New York, just from that 1 week. And it's like, people were just willing to make things happen for you. Like, oh, I know this person, you need to meet this person. Like, you cannot have an idea in New York and talk about it, because people will literally be like, I know five people you should meet. So you better be ready to execute. And I love that energy, because that, I feel like that's something that's missing in Chicago. People, it's there's not a lot of money to be made here, so it's not, people are not open to taking risks, which is fair, because there isn't that much money. We're not making $20,000-$30,000 that we should be making on a mural that we spend so much hard work on. And so I feel like from that standpoint, I do think that other cities are better, and Chicago needs to catch up there.
Yeah, other cities as in pretty much like
New York and Miami. Like, you know, there's not a, like, it's just, there's big money and it's hard.
Yeah.
Like, unless you end up at like Instagram, even there, you gotta know how to negotiate. You gotta have a bottom line price. And you literally add 5-10 grand to it or 20 grand to it, and you end up with your bottom line.
How's speaking of money, how does your pricing, how did that evolve over time from
That's
beginning?
Interesting. So like I said, I always knew I didn't want to be, like, I wanted to be a certain caliber artist. In order to get there, I knew I couldn't start low. And so it was, for me, it was never about surviving on this money. For me, it was about really exploring this passion, and which is why I made the decision to always do consulting on the side. Because I didn't want to have to sell a painting for $500 because I need to pay rent this month. Yeah. I wanted all of my expenses covered, and art was going to be the space that I would explore. And so my prices have always been high, and over the last 4 years, they've actually tripled at this point, easily tripled. Huh. Mainly because I already have a coveted print. Like, it's a print that's worth more than my original painting at this point.
Cool.
And so it's how you position yourself, how you brand yourself, being willing to say no to projects that don't align with your, you know, brand. Say no, and the only way you can say no is if you're financially a little more set up. So being able to say no is very, very important, way more than being able to say yes, because that's when people start respecting you and know that you have a certain standard you will not compromise. And I've, 2020, I've already said no to more projects than yes this year. Because I just am not willing to, you know, just take on any project that I don't feel connected to.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure if you have any minor or major following on Instagram, you probably get a lot of messages of someone like, hey, I'm thinking of doing this art show.
Yeah.
Do you want to work for free?
That sort of stuff. Rarely do I get anything for free. Even for charity now, I won't donate 100%. That was one thing, because that was one of my part of my strategy. I should mention that. I did a lot of charity events in, I'd say, 2016 and 2017. Every gala, everything I got invited to paint live, I did it. I used to charge $300 to paint live, I did it. Because for me, the exposure was incredible, because people kept seeing me again and again at different events, and suddenly they were noticing me. And by like end of 2017, people were literally like, dude, I see you everywhere, you're blowing up. And it's really, I don't know if I'm blowing up, because you're living in your world, right? Like, you have no idea how you're perceived. For me, it was just about really just working hard. And so I approached this as, like, this was my job, you know? And so when people now, when they ask me, what do I do? What else do I do, is a question I get. The digital marketing side of things is just what I do. I never mention it. I'm like, this is it. This is my job. I actually am an artist, right? And to be able to get there. I still remember the first time I mentioned I was an artist as my profession. It was such a bizarre feeling. Because you have to own it. And I wasn't ready to own it. And I was like, why am I not ready to own it? I actually paint. And it was, I think, in 2016 when I first time sat. End of 2016, I'm like, I'm an artist. And it was, it was really interesting. I'm like, if I'm not willing to say it, then who's going to take me seriously?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I've kind of quit saying I'm an artist.
You should. Work is good.
I just feel like I paint. I paint sometimes. I'm a painter.
You're an artist. You study math sometimes.
I study math sometimes every night.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, of course.
So tell me, like, this whole, like, creative positioning with art versus studying math. How does that work as far as, like,
I don't know. I don't know. I like both of them.
Yeah.
I like math. I really enjoy playing with numbers and creating ciphers and like playing with cryptography a little bit.
You think that's ever going to come into your work?
Possibly.
I haven't figured out how I'm ever going to do anything like that. Art.
Yeah,
you
would think so. I mean, it doesn't happen very much.
Okay.
Like, there's MC Hesher and his stairs. He did some stuff like that. There's one other guy I heard about who's making work now that the guy who was interviewing him was saying him. He's like the spiritual successor of MC Hesher. But I haven't checked his work out.
Well, Domitius' work had math in it, right? Like, the golden ratio was all part of his work, so.
Yeah, yeah, he was also very, very big into engineering.
Yeah.
He has that famous letter that says, and I can paint at the end.
right, that's you.
Which is incredible.
Yeah.
But, no, that's not me yet.
But I feel like that can eventually merge as like, the marriage of, like, different professions, which is why I feel like I've been successful because of my interest in business side of things.
Yeah.
I've been able to translate that and bring that into the art world.
But I think, I think you're onto something. Art and math and strategy all interconnects. Like, you could draw a Venn diagram pretty easily
100%
with that.
Right? Yeah.
Because there is just so much analysis that goes on within a painting. Especially, I've noticed that, especially starting to do a little bit of portraiture.
Yeah. It's all math.
It's terrible.
It's all math. If you're not doing math, it's so tough.
It's, because I started painting just doing some abstract stuff because I was doing really geometric sketches
and
laying it out and measuring and all that stuff, and I got kind of fed up with that because it's very tedious.
It's so funny because I tried that before. I didn't know I wanted to paint, like, figurative paintings. I thought I was going to do abstract. And it was so hard for me. I would get so caught up in math. And I did find joy in it. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was doing that and got really frustrated with the tediousness of it. And I just bought a bunch of canvas and spray paint and just literally broke stuff. Like, I broke some of the canvas. Because I needed some sort of release. And I was just thinking that I should break something. So I started painting a little bit, and then a guy that I befriended came around, and he's a fairly well-known painter. He's pretty good.
Okay.
And he said, I don't like any of this except for that one. It's pretty good.
Okay.
There's a good idea going on here. You should try that again.
I like that.
And so I started doing that and exploring like this abstract pointillism sort of thing. And then
someone just asked me if I would do a pointillism mural, and I'm like, oh my god, that's new territory for me. I'm like, I'm willing to explore, but it would
it
have
might
been
take forever.
Yeah. It would have, yeah. And I'm like, it's gonna, I mean, it's just, it, I wouldn't have been able to do justice emotionally. So for me, it's also like, it's not just the money. It's like, am I going to actually love creating this?
Mm-hmm.
So
pointillism,
yeah,
doing it horizontally on a wall,
I cannot even.
Very time consuming.
I can
imagine. I've never gotten
favorite.
Very far into
impressionism
it.
Impressionism is my favorite, like, style of painting to stare at when I go to Art Institute, like, Rainy Day in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea how to say his name, so I'm not going to try. He's French. It's my favorite painting there. And I just sit in front of it. There's a bench there, and I just stare at it. Like, I literally, legit, spend half hour there at a time. And I can't even imagine, like, that amount of patience. Although, I will say, I think I do, going back to that point of being able to spend months on a painting, I want to get to that place where I'm not rushed. I want to spend months on a painting because I have these ideas that I feel like, sometimes, I mean, I think I also feel like that also comes from the pressure of like me feeling a painting isn't done if I haven't put in like 40, 50 hours in it, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes I can finish a painting in an hour and it looks phenomenal. And I feel like it's not done. I feel like, I didn't earn the money because I only spent an hour on it. And my brother is very, like, he has a very business background. He's incredible financially. And so he teaches me, he gives me this, like, other spectrum of, like, things where he makes me see that, like, what you created in an hour, most people won't be able to create. That's why you bring this to the table. Mm-hmm. So value your work, not with the time you spent on it, but the uniqueness of it. He's teaching me that, and that's why I was able to bring up my prices a little bit higher even.
Yeah.
Because he's been coaching me through, like, okay, like, if you build a website in 2 hours, because I can find those websites for clients on Squarespace, for example, it doesn't matter if you build it in 2 hours. There are people who get paid for walking in, looking at a room, and consulting, and walking away in an hour and charge thousands of dollars. Because what they can execute, nobody else can.
Yeah.
It took a lot of work.
Well, in that same vein, it's...
Yeah.
It's kind of the techniques nowadays for most modern artists. It's the technique you develop, and then the painting's done.
And it's not that
pretty
simple.
Quickly.
It's, no, the techniques are not that simple.
Get very difficult.
It's taken years.
Very
complicated, like,
there's
sometimes. A new artist that I just fell in love with. There's no way I can, like, literally cannot pronounce his name. Alex something, I forget. His style, it's super abstract, stunning. And I tried to play with it just to play at home. It is so hard. But he does say some paintings take years.
Oh, yeah.
Even if it's the simplest abstract. Because it's like one of my favorite abstract artists of all time is Rothko. He was in the 60s, and he was a hermit, so nobody knows his process. He was very secretive about it, I guess very loner about it. But his paintings, there's this emotion. And I've literally only seen photos. So, actually, Detroit Museum, Museum of Art, I guess. There is a museum there. Has two paintings of his. So I'm literally going to just drive up to Detroit just to see those. But, like, his work, abstract, would take years.
And
you just don't know how people create, like, some of these works and what goes into it for a person to... Honestly, until I became an artist, I didn't appreciate abstract work. I just didn't. It takes so much discipline.
That.
So much discipline. The simpler the abstract, the harder it is.
Never made that connection.
Yeah, because, like, to create a specific effect and create this, like, mood that you can feel it takes a lot of work and discipline for the artist to not, turn it into chaos and make it loud. To be able to walk away. I respect artists who can walk away from an abstract piece by putting very minimal work in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it might look minimal, but, yeah.
Speaking of minimal, have you gotten into minimalism?
I am
before?
Actually. So my next series, that's what I will always keep my silhouettes, like the faces or whatever I want to do in as part of my work because that's what speaks to me the most.
Mm-hmm.
I may do a show where half the body of work is strictly abstract, half is merging my silhouettes with the abstract. So I'm working on, again, that's a work in development, emotionally.
Yeah.
But the complete minimalism I've done is the black and white work. But even that, I wouldn't call it minimalism. It's so much work goes into every emotion. Like, I get caught up in, like, the eyeball. like my painting Narcosis that people love, the girl biting her
eyeballs.
Lip. That lip bite took me forever. Like, yeah. I wanted to, like, it took me, like, over 2 hours to paint that bite.
Well, the worst thing I've done is I did a painting of this guy who has a lot of tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
He's covered.
Doing
those tattoos was mind-numbing. Very fulfilling at the end to finally
be done.
Just
walking away, oh my god, I can't even imagine.
But I would spend like 4 or 5 hours just working on like one word.
Oh yeah, this is why when people ask me to do any kind of calligraphy, I hate it. I won't accept those projects. I'll hire people to do it. Because I just hate it. And they're like, dude, your lines are perfect. I'm like, not with calligraphy, because there's a certain discipline.
Yeah, it's a different
animal. Just a completely different kind of beast. And I admire calligraphy artists so much. Like Emmy Starr, who's here, a local artist. Her work is insane. Her lines are perfect. Calligraphy is, like, she'll do big, huge murals with letters, and it's perfect.
Oh, yeah, you'll see. There's so many awesome Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
People, I don't know who
my
they
mind
are,
is
but they just
by those people.
Whip out these calligraphy pieces super fast, and it's just perfect.
I mean, doing it on a piece of paper versus large scale, it's a different kind of discipline. I can't do it. I don't have patience for it. Because, like, I would measure every edge and every corner, and it would be off, and I could just get caught up in all these details. Just not for me. But yeah, there are artists who are doing it, and it's beautiful.
Oh, since I did those tattoos, maybe I should go and try it.
You should try it. You might enjoy it.
What really drives me nuts is working on faces, and I'm just... I haven't sketched as much as I should doing portraits.
Yeah.
And I know what things should look like.
Yeah.
So I'm constantly frustrated because I haven't practiced to the point that I should to be able to know what's wrong. So I'll just sit there fumbling around with eyeballs for like hours, like, I don't know what's wrong.
I feel like
it's not
so
correct.
Being self-taught, there's pros and cons to it, right? The pro is that you can break the rules, you can paint outside of the lines, you can really develop your own technique. Nothing is failing, everything's just developing, right?
Yeah.
But then the con is that when you aren't trained, like, with the rules as far as like figurative painting, especially, or sketching, you really, the learning curve is huge.
Yeah,
so I'm actually thinking about taking some classes for figurative painting so that I can paint a little bit. Cause I think something I'm struggling with right now is, and meet artists who can create something very loosely. And I don't have that emotional freedom right now because I get so caught up in like the perfection of things that to be able to just create a face sketching and then painting it very loosely, I think it's going to be like my new next stage. Not the next series I'm developing. That's going to be very disciplined. But the loose work is what I'm really looking forward to. I can see myself doing that in a few years, where that's where I'll end up.
Well, it's very much, that reminds me of Picasso's curve.
Yeah.
He's very classically trained, but then you watch him
eventually
paint a face towards the end of his life when video existed. And
I mean, towards the end, like, he did have a lot of,
he'll
life.
Just, like, he'll be able to do in, like, 4 or 5 strokes a face that has distinguishing features.
Yeah.
And that if it was someone else, he could probably say, you know what, that looks like someone else.
Yeah.
And that probably comes from years of studying that
100%.
This kind of curve on the nose is what creates this kind of nose that you see in real life.
I'll actually send you a link to another artist that I love, 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 Angela, who does sketches, faces, and he does time lapses all the time, and I can watch them for hours. So on my free time, that's what I do. I watch a lot of artists' time lapses.
Yeah,
they are very
satisfying.
And then I kind of, like, sometimes it can be motivating, sometimes I'm like, okay, I don't want to create anything. Because I get
I'll
exhausted
be
emotionally watching that. But no, it's I think it's, like, such a wonderful thing when you have been. I wonder, though, if you get trained so strictly in such a specific style, do you then get caught up?
Probably.
Right?
You can break out of it, I'm sure.
That's what I'm trying to do.
I don't know what it takes.
Yeah. So my style is very singular right now, which is great. It's wonderful. Yeah. It got me noticed. But, like, I personally, emotionally, I'm ready to break out of it, and I'm trying to figure out how to do that. And it's a very frustrating process.
I don't know. I mean, my suggestion from just reading books would be to just try a different medium.
Right?
You know, like poetry or ceramics or something like that.
I could write, man. I have a writer in me. I'll write a book. A fiction.
Yeah, that would be my best guess.
Because
I can imagine,
yeah.
I can imagine if you don't put the space between physically painting and the ideas that accompany what your painting is.
That's a really good point.
Then when you... Yeah, once you make that space, you'll sit back down at a canvas with more of like a fresh perspective.
That's true, ideas. That's true. That's a really good point. Wow.
That'd be my guess.
That's a good takeaway, thank you. I love that. No, I'm totally going to try that because I haven't, like, I get so caught up. Mm-hmm. Right now, my current style is so, like I'm attached to it and it's easy for me to execute an emotion. I'm having a hard time kind of deconstructing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know from the times that I've jumped mediums, which happens occasionally. Like, I wrote 30,000 words in a book that I was going to write just like 6 months ago.
Okay.
And then right after that, once I got some space to paint, it was like a month of me painting every day.
Ah, that sounds great!
And then I hit a roadblock. But up until that point, like, it definitely did seem like going to writing for a little while.
Yeah.
Jump started what I was doing.
Okay. I'm gonna try that. I will try writing because I have a writer like hiding in me, which I love.
Yeah. I think they're very connected too.
Yeah.
Because like you said, there's a story, especially if you're doing a series of paintings, there should be some sort of story in there. Even if it's not written on the canvas or depicted in an image, you definitely create that theme or that mood.
Yeah.
I
guess I forgot about this. I have been thinking about a way of kind of breaking this medium, I guess. I want to create a little more storytelling, like not so cartoony, but like almost like in that arena. Fine art cartoons per se, if those exist. and create like a separate Instagram account that doesn't let me, that allows me to play. And create these right? Like, so I can create greeting cards, I can create, like, whatever, I can, books out of it, like, storytelling, like, kids' books, poetry books, whatever. So I'm thinking about starting a new Instagram, separate Instagram for this, and we'll see where I end up with it. It'll be a new style that I'm going to develop and play with it.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
Always go to explore a little bit.
If it fails, I'm not failing on my main account. I'm not failing on my breadwinner.
It's with that audience. We don't care about that one too much.
It's a different audience that I don't really care for yet. I may fall in love with them. You never know, man, where life takes you, though.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. That is definitely for sure.
Murals, I never thought I wanted to do murals.
I have been itching to do murals.
Oh, you should do one.
That was, so going back to my geometric sketching and some, I dabbled in mandala stuff a little bit. I wanted to transfer that to murals. And I even got like a compass that's a tape measure attached to it. And you can like stick it in a wall and create giant circles. I was thinking about that a couple weeks ago.
You should do it. You should do it. There's so many spaces to travel that would be willing to like... You know who actually would be a good place to start with? Gallery Cafe has this panels, wood panels outside. They would love to post your work there. It's a great canvas. It's
wood
8
panels.
Feet. Yeah, it's 8 feet.
Do they have people paint on it, or do you just... Okay.
Mm-hmm. You can do it there. Yeah, they would love to have your work there. Just talk to them.
That's cool. That's
it's a great place. And it's at the corner of North Avenue and whatever, Wood Street. So it's a very prominent area. Mm-hmm. You'll get a lot of footage on there. Yeah.
Y'all have to check that out and write that down.
You should do it.
Otherwise, I'll forget about it.
You should do it.
Gallery Cafe, right?
Gallery Cafe, Wicker Park, yes.
Gallery.
I love the people. Like, two brothers own it. They're just the nicest people ever.
Yeah.
They're just the nicest. That's one thing, man. I'll tell you, like, when you're networking, you make good friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. I made some really good friends in the industry. Which I love. I feel very lucky. I don't think I would have made it this far had I not built a community of artists. No. Cesar Perez is obviously like one of my best friends here, but like there are a few other artists that I like. I'm close.